Hey there, welcome to the Student to CEO podcast. I'm your host, Ashley Mason. We're talking to entrepreneurs who launched their business at a young age and they're now killing the game. Tune in to our episodes as these guests spill the dirt on taking that leap into entrepreneurship just like they did. Hey everyone, welcome to today's episode of the Student to CEO podcast. Joining me today is Colin McIntosh. Colin McIntosh is the founder and CEO of Sheets and Giggles, a fast-growing direct-to-consumer brand in the U.S. bedding space. Launched on Indiegogo in May 2018 with a $284,000 crowdfunding campaign, Sheets and Giggles became one of the few companies to make $1 million in sales in its first 12 months, with millions more in the following 12. The company also plants a tree for every order, planting nearly 20,000 trees in the U.S. from 2019 sales alone, and donates to causes that their community cares about. Colin, thanks so much for joining us today.
No, thanks for having me, and I appreciate the really wonderful intro.
Awesome. I'd love if you could start off by sharing with us what you do and how you got started.
Sure. So what I do is I sell bed sheets. that's kind of the way that I very bluntly kind of explain the company to people. But basically, I'm founder and CEO of a consumer brand called Sheets and Giggles, and a very different brand, obviously, you can probably tell by the name, than most of the other people in the bedding space, which is a traditionally very boring, very bland space. And our sheets are actually very differentiated as well. They're made out of a material called eucalyptus lyocell, which is considered by many to be the most sustainable fabric in the world. It's produced by a closed loop system by which trees are harvested and then turned into a fluffy fiber via a chemical process that reuses the solvents in every single batch. And then the fibers turn into a yarn, the yarns turn into a fabric, and that fabric is actually uses up to 96% less water than cotton sheets. It uses up to 30% less energy. It uses no pesticides or insecticides on the trees, whereas cotton by itself can be responsible for anywhere from 16 to 24% of the world's insecticide usage in any given year. And so, you know, it's not just a really, really high quality product and a very luxurious like sleep experience, but it's also a very sustainable product. And then also, it's a very funny brand, a very fun brand, and a very positive like giving brand. We just donated $40,000 to COVID-19 relief last month, which feels really great. So it's been a really great ride, and we're coming up on 3 years since I founded the company. October 2017 was when I founded it. And it's just really great for me to kind of take a step back sometimes and, check out how fast we're growing and, you know, how many people know our weird little brand name.
Amazing. And what made you want to get into the U.S. bedding industry specifically?
Well, I kind of touched on it briefly, but there were, I think that to take a step back in terms of like starting a business, the first thing that anyone should do is really identify a business model they feel very passionately about, in terms of the long-term viability, profitability, and scalability of the business model. And also the business model should be something that they believe they are the best in the world at. I happen to believe in my, you know, ego mind that I'm the best in the world at putting words on a page that convince people to take an action. And so I really wanted to do a consumer business, not only because of that, but also because I had background in a consumer business that was heavily physical retail that I had worked on with my friends for a few years prior to this. And I got a lot of firsthand experience in Shopify sales, in retail distribution. We worked, you know, I was running all of our business development. We worked with Target, Brookstone, HSN, QVC, T-Mobile, a bunch of other retailers distribute our product at my last company. And then we did a lot of Amazon marketing as well. And I basically learned a ton about selling, marketing, and distributing physical goods. So basically, long story short, as I sat down, I built exactly, followed my own advice. I built my perfect business model. I was 27 years old when I did it. And I wrote down, all right, I want a massive commodities market with very little brand differentiation or loyalty. So that way I wouldn't have to, you know, I could zig where everybody else was zagging. And then I also wanted something that was a very flat, boring brand space so I could be funny in a kind of undeservedly serious space. I wanted something that had a very low complexity supply chain. And what I mean by that is, you know, bed sheets and bedding and comforters and everything is still very difficult to produce and takes a lot of time and capital. But it doesn't have a Bluetooth component. It doesn't have firmware requirements. It doesn't have tooling needs, and it doesn't have, you know, a software team needing to be at the ready and paid at all times. And so I really wanted something with lower startup costs and lower complexity. And then I also wanted something that was heavily physical retail, so I could kind of bring it online with a more direct to consumer e-commerce model. And so last piece was I wanted a sustainable product that I would feel really good about selling and I would feel really good about contributing to the world with. And so I looked at my business model, and this is the honest to God truth. I looked at all the domains that I own, and I owned sheetsgiggles.com because I thought it would be a fun name for a bed sheets company at one point. I buy a domain every time I think of a business idea. And I said, this bedding fit my criteria, and it fit it almost perfectly. And so I was able to differentiate meaningfully on the eucalyptus lyocell as the fabric, as well as the brand voice for the company. And I was kind of off to the races.
That's amazing. And I love that exactly what you said. What you did was you focused on building that perfect business model to identify what you wanted in the company and how you wanted to serve others through it. And then because of that, you were able to come up with Sheets and Giggles. And I also love that you have domains ready, because I'm the same way. Anytime I think of a good domain, I'm like, I got to get it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I got probably about 50.
Yeah, definitely. But I mean, I do love the approach that you took with being able to build something like Sheets and Giggles by just kind of really analyzing it and creating a plan from there, and then being able to create a product that would satisfy all of those requirements.
Exactly. And I think that that's actually the best way to do it. And I think that way, and it's one of the things I actually honestly proselytize, and I'm actually am taking a note right now. I got to write a blog post about this because I've been asked about it a lot. But the thing that I think is really interesting for me is, like, and really kind of sad in a way, is I noticed that, like, a lot of founders will kind of do the opposite, where they'll have this problem that they really identify with very strongly. Maybe it's a personal problem to them or something that irks them. And then they've come up with a solution and an idea, and then they just go build it. And very rarely does that work. Like, sometimes it works and it blows up and you hear all about it, which is like, oh, this, you know, amazing entrepreneur, like, solved this huge problem. But, like, what usually happens is that people will spend years of their life and hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars, building something. And then they go to market with it and they try to sell it, and the market says, no thanks. Or more insidiously, the market will say, I really love what you've built, but I'd like it at this price instead of that price. And now you have a product that you have to sell for a margin that is below what a sustainable business model is. And so I think that everybody should really do kind of take very definitive steps when they start a company. Like, one is build a rudimentary financial model where you can basically say with confidence that if I can make something for this and I can sell it for this, and here are my other variable costs and fixed costs built in that I assume, do I think this can work? What's my break even? When can I reach that? How much capital do I need to burn through to reach that? Then they need to build a business model, like I said, that they feel like they're the best in the world at, they can execute on, and that they feel really passionate about, is like something that they want to work on for a long time. And then third is identify that product, that perfect product, and build. And you might even have an idea right in your head. Like, when I wrote my business model down, I knew I owned sheetsgiggles.com. I knew I owned sunglasseshalffull.com. I knew I owned, like, other, you know, other fun domains. And so, you know, I had this idea that I really wanted to do a sustainable physical product, but I didn't really know what category or vertical it would be in. And I think that that's the best way to do it, is to be, you know, product agnostic and let the market and your customers dictate what they want to see in the product, and let the business model dictate that.
Yeah, definitely. Because then you know that you're providing something that people are absolutely going to love and want to invest in.
Right. And then before you ever build anything, you should sell it. And there's different ways to sell it before you build it, right? You can do email signups, and describe it, and, you know, people will, you know, let you know, hey, I want to be in on this. I want this. Or you can actually literally go out and do pre-sales on a crowdfunding campaign or a Kickstarter or an Indiegogo. And, you know, it will feel bad if it doesn't work, right? If you have a 1% email sign-up rate and nobody wants to give you their email, or, you know, you make $5,000 on Kickstarter instead of the $100,000 that you were hoping for. Like, it's not the end of the world. I've seen plenty of friends do crowdfunding campaigns where they blow up and they don't work out, and they raise like a tenth of what they were hoping for. But the bottom line is that that friend, and I have many of them that did have done something like this, they know before they invest, you know, 6, 12, 24 months of their life, before they invest their life savings, before they go out and raise capital, they know if it's going to work or not. The market has kind of spoken. And I think that that's really powerful, because then you can quickly move on within a matter of months versus years.
You're absolutely right. You definitely want to be testing the water to not only see how people will perceive what you're going to be launching, but then also it garners all of that interest that when you do launch, you have people who are ready to give you their money instantly.
Bingo. Exactly. And if you are raising money from investors, or you think you eventually want to raise money from investors, there's two different pitches I see very often. And one of them is infinitely more powerful than the other. Like, and these are early stage, like, you know, very, very early stage pitches. One is like, I have this great idea. Here's the problem. Here's the solution. Do you agree with me? Please give me money. And I think that is so weak, because it has nothing behind it except for maybe some like market research. And then the second pitch is, I have this idea. Here's this problem. Here's my solution. I have 10,000 emails of people who have signed up for my solution, who are waiting to give me their money. Please give me money so I can take their money. That is a, like, you will get funded 10 out of 10 times with that second pitch. Like, you got to show that initial traction.
Yeah, absolutely. You want to be able to show that interest and be able to demonstrate it to others who have some type of stake in your company, and then be able to help you take that next step forward.
Exactly.
So Colin, keeping that in mind, and keeping in mind that you've been growing Sheets and Giggles for almost 3 years now, what has been the most difficult part of starting your business while young?
It's all difficult, and thank you for calling me young. I just recently turned 30, so I'm on the other side of wise. I think that it's all difficult, right? Like, it's not. It's funny. People ask a lot, what's the hardest part about starting a business? You know, having an idea worth starting is I think a blocker for a lot of people that don't want to take the plunge. You know, deciding to either quit your job or go without. I went without a paycheck for 15 months. That's extremely difficult, and if you don't have savings, it's almost impossible to do. I ran a second company. I ran an Amazon consultancy on the side. That made me $2,000 or $3,000 a month for 12 months in order to pay my rent and some food bills while I was starting this company. I stuff like that, like, you know, I worked 18 hour days, 7 days a week for, you know, a year and a half. I have had lost relationships. Like, I know that the question is more tactical in terms of like which piece is the hardest part, but like, honestly, the personal side of it, I think, is the hardest for me in terms of just needing to, like, I think a lot of people need to kind of understand and go into this like kind of eyes wide open when you're starting a business about how much of a daily struggle it is. And I think that we glorify entrepreneurship and starting a business in this country, which I agree is like everybody should, if everybody could do it, everybody should do it, because you'll never be independent unless you do. But I think that that's probably the hardest part, is the personal sacrifice and what that looks like. And I think a lot of people don't really understand exactly what that looks like. And then in terms of tactical, I think the hardest part is kind of like figuring out what you don't know and getting the mentorship to then figure that out. And I think that this is something that everybody can try to apply, which is, if you think that you're missing an expertise, you think that you, like, I didn't have any background in home textiles. Honestly, I had no textile background. And so I had to reach out to mentors of mine and investors in my last company and basically ask them, hey, you know, I'm looking for somebody with a really strong background in textile manufacturing. I was introduced to a gentleman named Mike, who, you know, became a mentor of mine for a few months. You know, I flew out to Los Angeles, cost me a plane ticket and a hotel. Met him, chatted, I got bottom lunch, you know, then a couple phone calls here and there. Then eventually I hired him on as a contractor. And then now he's my director of product and operations. And, you know, he's been full time with the company for a year and a half now. And so I think that that's the hardest part, is like figuring out what you don't know and then going to fill those gaps around it. And finally, I just say, like, getting that initial marketing traction and interest is very, very difficult. I've seen really, really tremendous products and companies fail because they simply couldn't execute on their marketing campaign.
Yeah, I agree with everything that you said, and especially the whole part about the personal aspect, because as you mentioned, that's one thing that people don't necessarily think about when it comes to the difficulties. They just think more about the strategy and development that goes into right. starting and growing a business, but not really how it can affect your personal life. Exactly like what you said with work-life balance and being able to take a salary and making sure that you're still maintaining relationships with others as you're focusing on entrepreneurship. I mean, there's so many different things that gets affected. And so I appreciate that you took the time to point that out.
Yeah, no, it's difficult. It's just something that I think that, you start a company and you have all these dreams about the way it's going to go. I think being very realistic about it is also very important. If I can give a little unsolicited advice is, you know, when I started Sheets and Giggles, my goal was not to raise venture capital. It was not to build the next Bed Bath & Beyond. It was not to compete with, you know, Bull & Branch or, you know, any other big names in the betting space. My goal was to make $3,000 a month in profit because I knew that that was my number that I could pay rent and live off of. And I figured once I can get to that number, I can tell everybody to F off. and basically, like, and that comes from my experience in my 20s of, you know, I've worked the world's largest hedge fund. I've been a recruiter. I've hired and fired many people. I've lost healthcare myself. I've gotten laid off at 1 p.m. on a Monday. I've gotten fired on a Sunday. I am a terrible employee. I think that you can only get laid off, so many times and go on COBRA and, you know, go through this really terrible healthcare system that we have in the United States, before you just kind of snap and like realize, like, I don't want to be beholden to anybody ever. For the rest of my life, when it comes to my finances or my family's healthcare or my own healthcare. And so, that's, I think, another piece of it is like to start with a very realistic goal about like what you're trying to achieve, and then make sure you take a second to like look back. I mean, we're doing hundreds of times more than I ever thought that we would do, per month. And that's really, one of the things that make sure I wake up in the morning and I'm very grateful for. It kind of got a tiger by the tail a little bit here. But when I started out, it was very tactical in terms of here's what I want to do and here's how I'm going to do it. And that's why we did the crowdfunding campaign, to get that version of the company off the ground without any outside investment or venture.
Yeah. And I love that you mentioned that your goal when first starting was to actually bring in $3,000 just to cover your expenses, because I had an extremely similar mindset. I mean, I started my company when I was 19. And so my whole goal was to take it full time after graduating from college immediately, which I did. But the thing that I did too, to be able to get there, was your same exact approach, was how much money do I need to bring in from my business each month guaranteed to be able to sustain myself moving forward. And then also, as you said, prove to people that it is possible and you can do it. So I think that that's a great way to be realistic and tactical about reaching your goals.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think a lot of people start off with the lofty, you know, I'm going to build a $1 billion company. Well, I actually have a really good friend that I went to Emory University with, one of my good college buddies, who did build a multi-billion-dollar company. His company just got acquired for $5.3 billion this year. By Visa. And I love this guy, and he's a great guy. I'm really happy for him. But the amount of people that I've seen over the years, I mean, I'm talking hundreds of founders and CEOs that I've met who have had to do an orderly wind down of their company or lay off all their friends on a Monday, is way, way, way more than just that one person. And so, you know, I think it's also being realistic in the sense of like, this is my first company. What do I think is a reasonable expectation for my first company? And it can be, I think, very important and humbling to have that kind of thought process going in, instead of, you know, I'm going to build the next Airbnb or I'm going to build the next Uber or whatever it is. Like, it's very unlikely that anyone does that. Like, right. just statistically, right? And so, you know, start with something that you feel is a reasonable goal and go forward from there.
I love that. So knowing that all that you wish that you had difficulty with starting through your business and things that were kind of a struggle for you both professionally and personally, on the opposite end, what was the most rewarding?
The most rewarding about starting a business, I don't have to listen to orders from people that I disagree with.
Amen.
I think you're really lucky in the sense of like you started your own business at 19 and you're lucky, but also no offense, you have like this kind of skewed perspective, I'm sure, of like what work and life is like in a way, right? Because you've never like really been in that like large corporate environment where, you know, a manager is telling you to do something and you disagree and they say, well, you're going to do it. And then we're going to have a meeting about why you disagree with me and why you're being like insubordinate or defensive or whatever it is. And like that stuff is nuts. And like, I think that like the society that we built for ourselves where, you know, you have to show up at an arbitrary time at an arbitrary place, dressed in arbitrary clothes, performing arbitrary tasks, that someone else assigns you, in generally speaking, arbitrary manner, in order to get your paycheck, which is really your survival check, your shelter check, your food check, your water check, your healthcare check. And then literally in the United States, we tie employment to healthcare. And so you've had, you know, 40 million people laid off because of the pandemic, right? And, you know, a lot of those people lost healthcare at the same time. And at what point, I think my question to a lot of people is like, at what point will people wake up and say, you know, wow, this is a really inefficient, you know, immoral system that we built where, you know, somebody can be fired due to a pandemic and lose their health care at the same time. It doesn't make any sense. And like how good somebody is at my company at selling bed sheets doesn't equate to whether or not their children or dependents should have health care. Like it doesn't, there's nothing correlated between those two things. And so, you know, I think the most rewarding thing for me is like, I'm a bad employee. I don't like taking orders. I don't, like authority. I got a problem with it. And, you know, going into my 30s, I feel almost entirely independent. And now I'm basically able to, you know, focus on the things that give me the most joy in life. And, you know, we've just recently taken the company fully remote. And so, you know, once I'm able to travel a little bit more freely, I'm looking forward to working from Europe and working from Asia and other places. And it's a real privilege to be able to do so. And I feel very, you know, both accomplished and lucky to, you know, be able to pack up my laptop and head where I want to go and have a fully remote team spread across the U.S. and globally and, you know, work with them from anywhere. So that's probably the best part is that freedom and flexibility. Even though it's still, you know, one of the great lies of entrepreneurship, I think, is that like, you know, you'll have more free time thing. You don't really have more free time, right? It's more like you have more flexible time. You know, something happens at 1 a.m. on a Sunday, you gotta deal with it.
Yeah. I think you hit the nail on the head with everything you just said, especially because that's one thing that I really feel passionate about too, is just not having to report to anyone and having freedom in so many ways outside of money and really in finances. And right. So that's one thing that really made me passionate about starting my marketing firm is that, I mean, the marketing industry is known for high burnout. It's something that puts people under a lot of stress. And so I know I didn't want to conform to that, especially because I have a friend that works in the marketing industry at a marketing firm. And she said that her bosses basically told her that because of everything that's happening with COVID, they are available 24/7, or they should be available 24/7 to speak to clients and work regardless right. of whether it's working hours or not. And I'm like, what? I said to her, I'm like, this is crazy. I'm that's like, nuts. I would never do that for anyone else, but I'm okay with working outside of the 9-to-5 for myself because it's right. for myself.
Yeah, and you're building your own equity. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. And so that's like a big difference, is just being able to not have to report to anyone. And I also like what you said too about how the whole freedom thing is kind of a lie, because it's true. I mean, being in Massachusetts, I personally take Fridays off to go to the beach during the summer, I'm working Monday through Thursday extra hours that I can accommodate for that. So I think it's great that you pointed that out, that even though we kind of have more freedom in a sense, it's because of flexibility choices that we make for it to happen.
Yeah. And that's, you know, I completely agree with everything you just, you're really hitting the nail on the head. I think, I think the thing that is actually the most, so I told you the thing that's most personally rewarding in terms of like kind of my own utility. The other thing is, you know, I'm a firm believer in like, you know, corporate social responsibility and a firm believer in leaving the world a better place than I found it. And, you know, one of the things that has been the most rewarding for me is kind of twofold. One is on my team side and on the employee side. I talk to my team, I have monthly one-to-ones with everybody at the company. And I ask them what are your important life goals? Are we hitting them? Or is the company a good vehicle for you to hit them? And, you know, recently I heard some things that, you know, people were, you know, enjoying the remote work and they like spending more time with their families. And they were, you know, wondering why they would need to commute at the end of this back to the office. And so we just decided to go full remote forever. And now, you know, people with young kids will be able to, those kids will have their parents around more often and have more time with them at home. You know, we'll have less commuting and less pollution because of it. And we'll also have more free time, all of us, and more flexibility in terms of where we live. You don't have to live downtown necessarily if you want a better place that's like slightly, you know, farther away from the, you know, where the office would have been in Denver. And so we have like a really, I think that's really cool, is like the ability to like impact that for people. And so I'm actually looking at giving Fridays off as well. We're looking at moving to a 4-day work week as well.
Oh, awesome.
Right. And so it's really cool that you're already doing that. And then the second thing I was going to say is, you know, we've donated $40,000 to COVID-19 relief. We planted 20,000 trees for 2019 sales. We've donated tens of thousands of dollars of bedding to homeless shelters in Denver, you know, for symptomatic individual overflow that's happening right now in Denver with the outbreak. And, you know, we really like take a, I think that we probably maybe do a little too much, to be honest, financially speaking, because we're still a small business, but I love it. Like, I love that I can look back and say, like, whatever happens moving forward, I've built a multi-million dollar business that's, you know, also raised millions of dollars and along the way has made like a very tangible, you know, very noticeable impact and difference in our local and state and national communities. And it just means the world to me as someone who's kind of got a bleeding heart as well.
I love that. And so with the success that you've garnered over the past few years, what do you think led to that outside of building that perfect business model?
I think you probably empathize with this. I think you have to be a little bit of a maniac. Like in a sense, like I don't
Very
think,
true.
I don't think that, you know, my, people that I've had past relationships with would argue with that. You know, I work a lot. Now I'm actually working fewer hours than ever, which is great. I'm probably working the least hours I ever have in my life. Which is really fantastic and has allowed me to focus more on my own physical and mental health recently, which has been great. I think that it's just something that you have to commit to. Like once you make that decision where it's like, I'm going to go all in on this, you've got to really give it a good try, because you'll know quickly, like you'll know within 6 months of whether or not your business is going to work out. But you have to be willing and ready to cut it, right? Like if it's not going to work out, you have to either be prepared to go find a job so you can regroup and think about your next move, or you have to be prepared to start something else if you have the savings and the runway to do that. But I think that the commitment that you make should be total for the first, you know, 6 to 12 months. And yeah, you're going to have less time to go hiking or camping or, you know, to, you know, maybe see some friends or family. I mean, in 2018, I think I barely saw my family, unfortunately. But 2019, because of what I did in 2018, I flew home to Florida 9 times from Denver. And I was with my nephew almost every month of his, you know, year 1 to year 2 life. And now he and I are best buddies. I think that work ethic is like pretty hardwired. And you have to have a certain neuroticism about being accurate with everything. Like you've got to know your numbers front and back. And as a former SAT tutor, I know our numbers front and back, and it drives my team a little crazy sometimes with how much data I demand from them. Yeah.
Yeah, but all of that stuff is so important for being able to take something like an idea of your business and then be able to really make something out of it. So I think that what you gave there was great advice on what people can really do to make sure that they're successful with their venture moving forward.
Yeah, hope so.
So if there is one thing that you wish you did differently or one thing you know now that you wish you knew then, what would it be and why?
One thing that I would do differently, I think, you know, for even despite everything I've said in terms of like sacrifice and working hard, you know, the sacrifice isn't to be glorified. You know, I don't like the hustle, right? In terms of like, CEOs and investors and everybody are always kind of patting each other on the back about like, you know, like, oh, I worked a 42-hour day, or like, you know, like I hustle harder than everybody else. Like I don't like that glorification of the hustle. I do think it's necessary. And I do think that it's, you know, something that you need to have and if you're going to be successful. But the advice I'd give to myself is probably that, you know, just always keep in mind, because you will lose sight of it. When you start a business, you'll lose sight of it. Always keep in mind that work is not an end. It's a means to an end. And sometimes you can kind of forget that. Sometimes you can, you know, just lose yourself in the month or the quarter or the year, or the task, even on a day-to-day basis, and you skip important functions, or you make excuses, or you're late, or, you know, you tell yourself in your head that people just need to understand that this is what I'm doing. But the truth is that people won't, and they don't, they don't have to. And so I think that that's also just important to keep in mind is like, it's a little bit lonely, and I would advise myself to make sure that I always keep in mind why I'm doing it. And that's something that I've actually been consciously telling myself over the last few months is like, you know, keep in mind why you're doing this and make sure that, you know, you don't lose yourself to the means and just keep focusing on the end.
Yeah, I think you said that perfectly. And I actually am reading a book right now that basically talks about that same idea, where it's called How to Live Danishly. And so basically Denmark is known as the happiest country in the world. And one of the things that led to that is because they have 32-hour work weeks. And so the author talks about how in the United States, we're often glorified if we work super long days at the office or stay late and stuff like that. But Denmark looks at it as, well, why weren't you more productive with your work? Or why didn't you get your work done in the right amount of time? Like, it shouldn't take you that long. And so just kind of thinking of that perspective, and exactly as you said, realizing that work isn't the end, it's like the means to it. And so being able to make those conscious decisions of how can I better improve my balance and be able to take care of myself rather than focus on only work is so important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that, that general concept of like, I think there's a ton of wasted time during the work week. I waste time all the time, right? Like I get distracted. I may have like an undiagnosed ADD or something. But yeah, it's, and then, you know, you wind up working 60 hours when you should be working, you know, 50 or 40.
Right.
And then, you know, same goes for people that are working 40 that, you know, could probably get their work done in 32 if they really put their head down. I completely agree with that. The glorification of work as a thing in and of itself is, I think very unhealthy, but unfortunately it's the society that we've got. And, I think we're going to be seeing some consequences of that in the coming months.
Seriously. Yeah. I think you said it right. But kind of going along with that, why do you think it's so important for individuals to start a business at a young age specifically?
Well, it's cool. So it's interesting because I have a conflicting opinion about this. I think that, on one hand, it's extremely difficult, and I'm very impressed with, you know, what you built. And I'm very impressed with my other friends who have started companies. You know, my buddy that sold his company for $5 billion, he started that at 22, right out of college. It's possible. And you hear these stories all the time of younger people starting, you know, big companies or successful companies. But the truth is that the younger you are, the fewer connections you have, the fewer savings you have, the fewer experience you have, and the fewer skills you have, it's exponentially harder without each of those things being at a certain place, because in order to start a successful business, you generally speaking need skills, connections, mentorship, capital, and experience. And so I struggle to say that I think that everyone should start a business when they're younger. I think if you feel like you're ready and you have that business model that you feel very passionate about, on the flip side of that concern is that there's no time like the present, especially if you're young, to start a business. Because like, think about things in terms of, and I've always done this with my career, and it's why I started the business at 27. You know, but even at 27, I had 5 years of like world's largest hedge fund, recruiting and hiring experience, retail sales, scaling to thousands of stores, Amazon channel marketing. Like, you know, I had these, you know, supply chain and logistics. Like, that stuff just doesn't happen without going through some serious learning and lumps through a career. But you know, that caution being said, if you think about best case, worst case scenario, if you're young and you start a business, like, what's your worst case scenario? Like, oh, I'm going to miss out on a few years of earning like 40 grand. Like, you know, like it's not, and that sounds very flippant and dismissive of the people who are earning 40 grand, but like, it's more of like, if you start something that at 22 or 23 or even younger, and you know, you're in college, right? Like, say you're in college, what's your worst case scenario? If your business fails, your worst case scenario is that you're still in college. And then you will still like go apply for jobs.
Yeah.
And so like, if your worst case scenario is just to like make the median US income, or your worst case scenario is, in my case, my worst case scenario was kind of, I guess I'll just go work at Amazon or Microsoft if I have to, which is like a really good worst case scenario. I guess my question is like, why wouldn't you start a business? You know what I mean? Like, what is the scary thing? Is it just the fear of failure? I think that that's the one thing that holds a lot of people back, is that like fear of failure. It's the uncertainty. It's the instability. It's the, you know, fear of, you know, giving up on one job. That's kind of a more certain quote unquote thing. But the reality is I've been fired by a company that has $170 billion under management. And I've been fired by a company that ran out of money the day before they had to let everybody go. Like, there is no stability if you are not the one driving the decision making at the company. Even at a fast growing company, even at a great company, even at a profitable company, you're always going to be at the whim of your manager's subjective opinion of you, and that's just the truth. And so I think that if I'm looking back on my early 20s, I wouldn't trade those experiences for anything, because they built me into the kind of person that I am, and they were very formative. But yeah, I absolutely would have started a business in college, no doubt, because I would have learned so much going into that. Like, your worst case scenario is that you learn a ton and then still go do the things that you were going to do anyway. Like, it's, yeah, not, like, that starting a business at 40, your worst case scenario is potentially like, you know, blowing your life savings and, you know, causing your family some struggle. That's a very different thing. Now, that being said, people who start businesses at 40 are usually more successful than people who are younger, because they have all that experience and saved capital and connections. But, you know, it's a much higher risk at that age. But yeah, I mean, no house, no family, no major commitments, like, start a business.
Yes, I love what you just said, because I actually have a client who gives that same exact advice, where she talks about fear often, and she's like, think about the worst possible thing that could happen if you were to do something, and then make a plan for if that worst possible thing happens. And then it really helps to relieve that anxiety and the fear of the unknown for moving forward and making that decision. And so I think that what you said is so true about just thinking about, well, if you're young and you want to start a business, what's the worst thing that could happen of this? And truthfully, when you put it into perspective, it's not as bad as you think.
No, it's not. I mean, and one piece of advice around that I'll say is, I have friends who their entire personality is their company. And I really try to really try to not do that with Sheets and Giggles, because I've seen companies fail. I've seen companies fail that I did not expect at all to fail. Blown away that they failed. Like, oh my gosh, how could that company go under? And especially now with what we're seeing with the US economy and how quickly things can change on a dime. And so my word of caution is, don't make your business your entire persona. People will tend to do that, especially with social media, where they only or exclusively talk about their business or post about their business. And it's almost as if they don't have, you know, anything else. Or they do have other things in their life, of course, but if you looked at their social media, you wouldn't know it. And so I think that that can be very, very risky and damaging to your psyche. If your company does go under, I've seen a lot of people feel like they are failures, like they have failed as people, as humans. And that's just not the case. The corporation has failed. The corporate entity, the business model, the product, that is what fails, not the person. And it's okay for people to fail, but it doesn't make you a failure. And so I want to make sure that, you know, anybody who does start a business keeps that in mind to, you know, make sure that they stay well-rounded and that the business doesn't consume who they are. Because if it does not work out, then it will be almost impossible to let go of.
I think that's so important about really just focusing and making sure that your business is only a part of your life, not your entire life.
Exactly. Exactly. And again, it goes back to it being a means to an end, not an end in itself.
Yes, 100%. So Colin, you have shared such amazing advice through your story throughout this podcast episode. And the last thing I'd like to ask you is that if there was one last piece of advice that you could give to our listeners for someone who may just be starting out, what would it be?
One last piece of advice. I feel like I've given some of my favorite ones. This is just something that I believe that I don't know if it's true or not. Don't work with friends.
Good one.
It's not worth it. I've done it. And it, you know, I'm lucky that I'm so close with the person because we had a tough time for a little while after everything went down. You can do like, if you really intrinsically trust someone and love someone, you can go into business with them, but like, that's the only way I'd do it. Number two is probably on the same route. I think something like 80% of businesses fail, because of co-founder, issues and co-founder disagreements. So I remember I learned that stat and I like wrote down in my notebook and I was like, it's simple, kill all the co-founders. and so I don't, not this, like starting a business is lonely. Like I look at my friends that have co-founders and I'm jealous because I'm like, oh, like it must be so nice to like have someone to like, you know, talk to and like always have like that partner on your team. But at the same time, again, unless you are like 100%, like I love this person, I trust this person with my life, I would not go into business with somebody in an equal partnership perspective, because I think that it is so risky to give somebody else that power over something that you're going to be building. And you know, you can give equity to employees, you can, you know, make people owners of your business, you can sell equity to investors. But I think that co-founders need to be very, very, very carefully chosen. And I would not choose them based on like complementary skills. I would choose them based on level of trust.
I like that. I think that's a good one.
Thanks.
Awesome. Well, Colin, I'd love if you could now share where our listeners can find you online so that if they'd like to connect with you further or ask you any questions, they know how to reach you.
Yeah. So I actually, it's funny. I'm really easy to find. Colin McIntosh. You can find me on LinkedIn or, you know, just Google Sheets and Giggles, Colin, you'll find me. I'm on Twitter, but I also just started, I'm not very active on Twitter. I also just started a blog that I don't know how active it's going to be, but if you're listening to this, you can go to colinblogs.com. And it is very, very basic. I haven't written my first post yet. So, you know, but I literally started it this week. But you know, I'm going to be writing about certain things that I think are very interesting to me, like how to crowdfund properly, starting a business, like I talked about here, you know, politics, you know, personal relationships, you know, different things that I think about that just kind of bother me enough to the point of writing. So if it's if you're listening to this and you go to colinblogs.com, it might actually be a functioning website by that point.
Awesome. And I'll make sure to link to everything in the show notes, including your blog. So that way anyone can click through and explore more from there.
Awesome. And don't email me. it's a miracle that Ashley and I ever connected because my email inbox is a complete wasteland.
I won't include that, but I'll include everything else.
Okay, great.
Awesome. Thanks again for coming on, Colin.
Thanks, Ashley. I appreciate you.
Thanks so much for listening today. I'd love it if you could subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with those who could use it most. For show notes and more information, go to studenttoceo.com forward slash podcast.